So what I was thinking tonight is to speak about the what I refer to the existential recovery dimension, or the existential component of recovery. And when I use the word existential, I use it in quite a broad term. Normally, sort of existential, the word existential is derived from existential philosophy and more recently existential psychology or existential psychoanalysis, which refers to the study of being, and in a more popular way, the study of our meaning in the world, what makes our lives meaningful. And in the way that I use it is more in that context of what gives us meaning in the world, and not just simply cognitively, but also how we relate to that meaning. And meaning is always, as the phenomenologists would say, meaning is, or consciousness, or meaning in this case, is always directed with the intention towards something. So, you know, existentialism or existential impulses don't exist just in isolation. It exists as part of our being in the world, as part of our relationship with things. So in the context of recovery, the existential dimension would also include what conventionally is referred to as spirituality. And I used to sort of include existential under spirituality, but my thinking more recently has been is to include spirituality under existential, as a banner in a way. So I think existential is a more broader category and inclusive of spirituality, because there are also a lot of people that aren't spiritual or religious or have no spiritual inclination to whatever meaning. So, existential isn't, it's not, if you don't have spirituality, you can't be existential. I think it's the other way around. Everyone is existential, but some people to choose to manifest their existential impulses in a spiritual manner. So I want to speak about sort of existential aspect of recovery, and then I will include what's normally referred to as sort of spirituality within recovery. And I want to keep it to recovery because obviously spirituality is such a broad concept and context that one can't begin to address it in an hour. So I'll speak about it more in the context of our spirituality is normally used in the context of recovery from addiction. So I think to sort of start off really is that one of the, you know, there's many etiological models around addiction, why people are drawn towards addiction, why people take drugs in the first place, and then consequently why some people become addicted. And some of them all, what they call the sort of, I suppose, what could be called more existentially orientated theories or etiological models of addiction are ones that basically say that people turn to drugs due to a lack of meaning. And that's not very far off from what the 12-step, what's in 12-step philosophy. In 12-step culture, and if one reads the big book closely, what they point out, I mean, one often hears that addiction is a spiritual disease. And in the context of the 12 steps, they would say that people turn to drugs due to lack of spirituality. I would prefer to say that due to lack of meaning. And I think the meaning incorporates what Aya and those guys refer to as lack of spirituality, because if there isn't spirituality in their opinion, there could be no meaning. So what a lot of people believe is that if somebody grows up in an environment for whatever reason, intentionally or not from his caregivers or cults or whatever, and his environment doesn't provide an adequate sense of meaning, or he can't find meaning for himself within his environment, then the idea of or not the idea of turning to drugs, but when one encounters mind-altering substances, they become very appealing. There's you know, there's very few things that provide such an instant sense of meaning as taking mind-altering substances. And if you look at the sort of more psychedelic cultures, the hippies in the 60s and the sort of psychedelic revolution of the 90s that's, I suppose, still going on, you can see a lot of the kids are attracted to that and find a huge amount of meaning within that culture. So in a way, a drug culture, not just the drug in itself, but the cultural connotations that the drug is taken within, instantly provides a sense of belonging, a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, a sense of what's right and wrong, or what's meaningful or not, you know, etc. It's got its own value and culture. So, you know, I personally believe that a very large percentage of people that become addicts very often came from a sort of existential barren background. Because my opinion is that the need for meaning is a very innate need. And I think guys like Viktor Frankl would echo that in many ways, is that, you know, we're born with sets of needs. We have physiological needs, we have psychological needs for belonging, love, care, etc. But I think as human beings, we're also born with an innate need for meaning, that we need to make sense of the world, and we need to make sense of our place in the world and what to do. You know, the old question of what's the meaning of life, or, you know, what should I do with my life? And for me, that's a really important thing in the context of recovery, because if recovery doesn't provide an adequate sense of meaning to people, then recovery can really just remain quite a barren process, or sort of a process of what's that, self-flagellation in a way, or something that you just do because you've been wrong and now you have to do all these things to, you know, fix yourself, etc. And I think the people that manage, you know, the people really in recovery are people that find a significant amount of meaning in their recovery process as well. That doesn't just see recovery as this thing you have to do so that one day your life can be, you know, sorted, but that recovery itself can be a very meaningful enterprise. And maybe just saying something to add to that, the other aspect that I think goes, that's very closely connected from an existential perspective and very closely connected to one's desire for meaning, is also that some theorists believe that we're also born with an innate, sort of a built-in need for altered states of consciousness. And when I mean altered states of consciousness, I'm not talking about just extreme altered states of consciousness that stuff like drugs provide, but even in a more general, in a more softer sense of the word, that all of us have to experience these altered states in our lives for one to remain a sort of balanced, healthy individual. And I think many people discover their sense of purpose or their sense of meaning within these altered states. And if one looks at sort of primitive cultures, or archaic cultures, many of these cultures had very built-in mechanisms within their culture and society that provided altered states of consciousness for people on quite a consistent way. And when people experienced these altered states of consciousness, there was a certain sense of connection with a tribe or the group or whatever. And within these altered states of consciousness, it was very often dressed up within the tribe or culture's religious or spiritual ideas as well. It wasn't just, you know, let's dance on a campfire and get high and, you know, chant some random stuff because it feels good. It is very often very closely linked with their idea of the universe and what it means and their place in it. So that altered state of consciousness sort of solidified people's value system or their need for meaning and sort of so gave evidence for it, but there was a very experiential feeling that, listen, my life has meaning and things make sense, etc. So I think for many people that grow up that don't have that experience, from a meaningful perspective, the alteration of consciousness that drugs provide, I think in many ways, although people, I think most people aren't really aware of that, but on a subconscious level perhaps, or even a very innate biological level, really speaks to people very largely, because when they experience that alteration of consciousness, it feels really right. And one only has to look at drug cultures like the rave culture or the psychedelic culture with trance parties and all that stuff, and you can see that this is much more about just people taking drugs and just dancing. There's a very ritualized, in a way, sort of archetypal or archaic process that's also happening within those processes that make it very appealing and very meaningful to people. So I suppose in the context of recovery is that if one enters recovery, the meaning that one found in active addiction needs to be replaced in a way with a recovery culture or recovery practice or recovery spirituality, whatever one chooses, that one would find equally meaningful. I mean, even cultures like heroin addiction, which most people would see as, as not a very meaningful activity. I would argue on the contrary that even stuff like heroin addiction provides a huge sense of meaning to somebody, provides a sense of fellowship, provides a brotherhood, it provides certain rules how to live life, and there's nothing more existentially motivating than waking up sick in the morning from cold turkeying and going to score heroin, because you know exactly what you're going to do, you know how to do it, you know what to do, and it's a very clear path. Might be completely insane and destructive, but on a more sort of archaic level, it's very meaningful. So what a lot of people would say is that, as I said earlier, recovery needs to supply that meaning to people in a similar spectacular way as addiction and the culture of addiction supplied it to people in other ways, albeit destructive ways. Anything anybody wants to add or ask before I go on? Are you guys still with me on that?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Very much with you. That is really that really resonates, that need for ritual and all that goes along with it. That's very interesting.
Yeah. There's a guy called Zoja, Luigi. Oh, sorry, Luigi Zoja, Z-O-J-J-A. He wrote a book called Drugs, Addiction, and Initiation, which basically explores the idea of initiation, and ritual that's hidden. It's not really that well hidden, but
Hello?
Hello?
We lost you for a second, Guy.
Is it? Am I back now?
Yes.
Yes.
Anyway, no, long story.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh.
No, you're cutting out. Interesting.
I was wondering, in my case, I experimented very heavily with hallucinogens before I got into, let's say, dangerous addictive substances like crack or little mild heroin phase, and then, of course, crystal meth and cocaine and stuff. And I wonder if the love affair that I had with psychedelics and that whole sort of way of life and that initiation and that culture, I wonder if that somehow increased my, I'm sure it did, my love of of drugs, and if it almost paved the way for me to become addicted.
Yeah. Well, I would say yes. If you look at the 60s culture in San Francisco, you know, in 1960, from 67 to...
Hello?
Hi, can you hear me?
You broke up a little bit again.
What's going on here? But if you look at the hippie culture in the 60s, you know, everyone was on LSD in the late 60s. And then within 2-3 years, a significant portion of all those people that went to psychedelics, you know, eventually turned to speed and heroin, you know, and then Haight-Ashbury was full of heroin addicts in the early 70s. So one can just see how quickly that idealistic drug using turned nasty very quickly. And I think a very, very similar thing happened in the 90s as well, when there was quite a big sort of psychedelic revolution in the early 90s. And within a couple of years, a lot of those people were smoking crack and coke, and heroin, and eventually crystal meth. So I think it initially speaks to one in a very innate, archaic way and pulls you in. And then that opens the path to, more dangerous drugs. I mean, there's very few people that would, you know, immediately go to heroin and see that as speaking to a deep sense of meaning. You know, just that just doesn't make sense.
That's interesting. I never thought of that.
If one looks at the paraphernalia of drug use, the symbolism around a lot of the drugs, you know, if you look at heroin, people cook it up in a spoon, they use a syringe that's very phallic. You know, you take the syringe, you stick it into your vein, directly into your bloodstream. There's also this whole, I don't want to get too Jungian, but there's this whole sort of alchemical fantasy involved in drug use as well, where the drug is nearly seen as the philosopher's stone that gives you immortality. Not in a literal sense, but in that moment where you ingest the drug, there is a feeling of sort of indestructibleness or immortality or ultimate control. Where the drug becomes a sort of magic elixir that transforms you into a nearly a superhuman state. So there's a lot of parallels with that and the sort of alchemical myth, or metaphor rather. So, you know, I think there's so much unconscious processes that happens in drug cultures that for anybody that's susceptible, not in a negative way, but also very intelligent, clever people, would be very, very susceptible to those type of very powerful, you know, and I use archetypal for the lack of a better word, really, those very archetypal things that it speaks to in one, you know, especially in the Western culture where most kids go through, you know, fairly mindless forms of initiation. You know, go to university and your initiation is to down, you know, like a liter of wine or something, or, you know, whatever. And, you know, our culture just doesn't provide these types of initiation, especially for men, where they get initiated into adulthood. And if you look at the drug cultures, there's these very different levels of initiation and a sort of ranking system. You know, you just take that type of drug, I take this type of drug, I do it in this way, and you get initiated into the different hierarchies of the culture, which is very powerful, very powerful. And I mean, that's the same principle that gangs and stuff like that works on. And if I can just maybe add to that, am I still cutting out?
Yeah.
No, you're
I wonder, you know, there's this growing sort of emerging culture around this idea of something called transformational festivals, which are kind of like
they all have their roots in the early sort of thriving underground cultures of the early 90s, that underground electronic dance culture. But these are older people now, and these festivals are kind of like raves, but not so much centered on the party. They usually have workshops. Actually, all of them have like workshops, and a lot of them are very yoga intensive and meditation intensive, and they're community based, and there's whole sort of culture around it. And I've never been to one. It sounds interesting to me. It sounds very exciting, but I feel that there's still this sort of hush-hush hallucinogenic sort of tone around all of them, where people are trying to achieve altered states of consciousness, even if it's in a more holistic, quote-unquote, integral way or whatever with the yoga and the meditation. But I still feel they're doing the same thing, and it concerns me if that is paving the way for more addictions down the road, you know, the same way that people in the 60s or myself or whatever in the 90s got addicted, because eventually I guess those psychedelic trips just weren't enough or whatever. Are you guys familiar with what I'm talking about? Those festivals that are probably, I guess, like Burning Man would be like the ultimate one, which just got started like a few days ago.
Yeah, I mean, I would have
picked. Yeah, and go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I've got a significant problem with those type of things. I've got absolutely no problem with people saying, "Hey, let's go out and get high and dance and have a good time," because that's very clear and that's very honest, you know. And people should, as far as I'm concerned, have an absolute right to do that, you know, as adults. But what I do have a problem with is if people give very sort of transpersonal spiritual notions to that type of activity. You know, if one looks at the 60s, the amount of enlightenment, if you can call it that, that came out of the drug culture, it wasn't a lot, you know what I mean? If you read the literature of the 60s from the LSD, you know, the LSD culture, there's not much there that is of any value as far as I'm concerned. You know, even guys like Timothy Leary and those guys eventually turned away, especially Leary, turned away from the notion that LSD or psychedelics is really a method for enlightenment, and turn towards more sort of cyber electronic notions, that a more sort of transhuman type of stuff, notion. But I think what you're saying there is right, Hamlet, is there's always a, you know, whether people do it, you know, yoga, this or all these things, there's always this underlying, subtext that, you know, we're not okay. And we need to, you know, transcend to something special or amazing or whatever, because whatever's going on just isn't okay. And I think there's very often a sort of inflated narcissism behind all that stuff, that people assume that they, you know, should be these sort of spectacular human beings, or should be at all these spectacular levels of development, etc. Whether these levels even exist or not is even debatable. But, you know, I think within those cultures, there's, like Wilbur would say, there's a small percentage of people that's actually authentically driven by a desire to develop and transcend themselves. But as far as I'm concerned, the reality is with most of those cultures, most people at the Burning Man isn't there to, like, join in, you know, community and transcend the limitations. They're there to have a good time and get high and have a party. Like I said, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you confuse pre-personal values, which would be, you know, let me get high and have a good time, with transpersonal values, then you start running into problems. What Wilbur and those guys would refer to as a sort of pre-transpersonal level. You know, the pre-personal, transpersonal fallacy. that I think it's all bad, but as in a general sense, I just think there's a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of confusion that very often happens in these type of environments.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe just to move forward a bit. So in the context of recovery, obviously one of the most prominent forms of finding meaning is always being considered a spirituality. Spirituality has been given quite a prominent place, and I think the sort of start date of that was really Bill Wilson's or Bill W's own what could be called a spiritual experience that he had in hospital right at the end. Apart from the fact that he was also on a bit of belladonna, which is a mild psychedelic, which they used to give people in the cities for alcohol, you know, alcohol treatment, which I'm sure helped his spiritual experience along a bit. But apart from that, he had some spiritual experience and consequently, read quite a lot of William James's work, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which a guy called EBT, sorry, my throat is a bit, read quite a lot of William James's work, which this guy called EBT gave him, and framed his own spiritual experience within a certain context, obviously influenced by William James's stuff. I think in many ways, a consequence of those couple of events, spirituality became quite a prominent place within 12-step culture. And in many ways, one can see the 12 steps really as a framework for spiritual awakening or mystical awakening. In fact, one just has to look at step 12 that says, as a result of working these steps, we had a spiritual awakening. Obviously, the word spiritual awakening can be interpreted in many ways. But one can also interpret that as sorry, somebody's mic is just making quite a lot of noise in the background. Okay, that's a bit better. Thanks. So one could also call that a sort of existential awakening, that one just awakens to some idea or some purpose that just makes a lot of sense. Whether that is spiritual or not is I think optional. So in spiritual practice, I think one of the values that Wilbur and those type of guys brought to spiritual practice, or the notion of spirituality, is to provide a sort of classification for spirituality from a sense of from a perspective of development, but also a type of typology. So I think the first typology that's quite interesting is what Wilbur calls the Wilbur-Combs lattice, where are you guys familiar with that little graph or picture, the Wilbur-Combs lattice?
No, I don't know that.
Okay. Well, basically, in a nutshell, what they say is that depending on somebody's stage of development, whether you're in a sort of archaic or mythic or rational or whatever stage of development you are, your, let's call it spiritual experiences or mystical experiences, are going to correlate with your level of development. And there's also different levels of spiritual experiences, what they refer to as gross, subtle, causal, and non-dual. And each of these different types of experiences are interpreted differently on one's sort of state, level of development, which I don't want to go into now, especially not over a sort of verbal conversation, because one has to sort of visualize in a way. But So what's interesting about that really is one, if one looks at that, that design of Wilbur and Squires and Wilbur and Combs, is that one can really plot or understand what a spiritual experience it is that one had and at what level the experience was, which gives it, one, say, validity, but one can make sense out of that experience. And as Wilbur and those guys say, and I think that's a problem with the psychedelic culture, is just having an altered state or spiritual awakening, whatever, doesn't necessarily translate into stage development. There needs to be practice that enforce that development consistently, which, for instance, something like meditation does. You might have a spiritual awakening and something like Zen or the Kensho or some form of awakening. But if you don't have a consistent practice, that awakening is going to fade and after a while probably have virtually very little effect on one's overall development or just in the way one lives the world. So spiritual awakenings, one can call it that, has to be in conjunction with a sustained spiritual or existential practice or contemplative practice for it really to be sustainable. And what Wilbur and those guys say is that there's sort of three perspectives of spiritual practice that one can have, or three different methods of spiritual practice that correlates with the first, second, and third person perspectives. And just to go over that briefly is what they say, first person spirituality or first person spiritual practice is, as the first person would say, is I or me or whatever. And that's a practice that you do in a way in isolation. And meditation is probably the most well-known form of that where your spiritual practice is just about you and your, experiences of that practice, which obviously has many benefits. But what they also point out is that there's two other forms of spiritual practice, and different religions tend to focus on different types of perspectives. So for instance, say like Buddhism would place a huge amount of emphasis on the first person. And then something like Christianity or maybe more mythic religions would place a huge emphasis on second person, which is you, between me and you, which is more of a, I won't say worship, but more sort of relational communion type of spirituality where you have some relationship with a higher power in the sense of, I mean, the 12 steps is a relationship with a higher power. In religion, there's a relationship with God. And there's also secular ways of understanding that as well. And then in the third person is more where it's where you actually observe spirituality or your higher power, or God, or whatever you want to call it, from a third person perspective, which is something like contemplation or study. Something like philosophy would be considered the third person of spiritual practice, where you read about it, you contemplate about it, you think about it, you gain the information. And basically what Wilbur and these guys are saying, whether they're right or not, you know, it's debatable. That's not really for me to say. But what they say is that a healthy spiritual or contemplative practice, and I would call it the existential practice, needs to have all three of these elements. So there needs to be a first-person practice. There needs to be some relational practice. And there also needs to be a third-person practice where you actually get some information and cognitive insight, etc., around whatever it is that you find meaningful or spiritual, whatever it is, whatever words one wants to use. You guys still with me on that? Further on?
Yes.
So maybe just something that I can add to that, from a sort of secular perspective around the second person spirituality, which I find quite interesting, is that I think it's very difficult for non-religious people to have a second person spirituality in the conventional sense of the word, where there's a relationship between you and you know, especially if you're not religious, then there can't be a relationship with anything because you don't believe in anything. If you're an atheist, you can't have a relationship with something that you don't believe in. But second person practice, from an existential point of view, I think is actually probably the most important aspect of an existential or spiritual practice. And in the context of recovery, I would see that as absolutely essential. So a way for one to understand that is that the existential philosophers, what they, some of the, it's called wisdom that they brought to philosophy as well, especially guys like Heidegger, brought the notion of what he referred to as being in the world. And what that simply means is that until fairly recently, most philosophers and most scientists used to understand a human being as an object that would, or as a subject that would study objects, and as a sort of independent existing being, that had interaction with other independent beings. And what guys, existential philosophers like Heidegger, pointed out is that our being is always being in the world. Everything we do, everything we are, everything we think is always intimately connected with objects, with culture, with all of these things. So we can't exist as independent subjects. We can't exist independently from the world. We really are the world. We're obviously a luminous point to some extent of what we call the eye, but you know, our boundary doesn't stop with, you know, your skin. You're very much part of your world, more so I think than most of us would realize. So from an existential perspective is that we're always in relationship with things. You know, there's never a split between that. So if one brings in, Heidegger also refers to this thing as called a mood, which is quite an interesting concept, very simple concept, but an interesting concept. He basically says any interaction we have with anything, you know, whether it's making your toast in the morning or interacting with your child or partner, whatever, there's always a mood present. So this mood can be pleasant or unpleasant or fun or boring or whatever, but there's always an emotional component with all of these things. And what is very useful to look at it from that perspective is the idea, what NA and AA calls the spiritual principles, which I think is an unfortunate word because these principles are, you know, very often outside the, you know, honesty is, you know, more than just the spiritual principle or open-mindedness or whatever. But the way that we interact with the world, if one isn't religious in that sense, is very much determined on our mood, this emotional, intellectual, that's a mixture of all these things, and that clouds the way we experience the world and the way we interact it and the way the world influences us in return. And I think from a second person perspective, I prefer to call that one's existential attitude. So that is the attitude that you have towards all things. So if one sees that in the context of a second person spirituality, is the spirituality that you practice is really the attitude that you have towards all things at any given time. And in recovery, that, like I said, that's referred to as the spiritual principles, which I think is probably the most underutilized aspect, very often, because recovery is often seen as practices. You know, you do this, you go to meeting, you do step work, you phone your sponsor, blah, blah, blah. You do all these things. For me, the most important thing is not what you do, but is your mood or your attitude towards the things that you do. Because you can sit in a meeting with a shitty attitude. You can phone your sponsor and not listen. You know, you can meditate, you can do yoga, you can do anything with a crappy attitude or a crappy mood. And that is going to influence the way that you experience that, and it's going to influence the way whether it benefits you or not. So for me, one of the most essential things really is looking at one's what Heidegger would call mood, or what I prefer to call existential attitude, or what N.A. would call one's the spiritual principles that one applies, and as they call it, you know, applying the spiritual principles in all your affairs. And I think that's where I think the most important aspect of any form of spirituality lies is really in the second person interaction with things that you find meaningful, whether you find it through an higher power or God, or in secular ways, through art, with your children, through whatever it is. I don't think the object matters at all, but I think what really matters is the mood or the attitude that one has when you engage with all of these things. And I think it's within that attitude that one either gets better or doesn't get better. I like to use the definition of spirituality as the quality of the relationship we have with ourselves, others, and our being in the world. And it's this very mercurial quality of the relationship that you can't really see or touch or even really very often notice, that I think is the glue that holds all of these things together. And as far as recovery goes, which is the context of what we're talking about, it's really that that very mercurial quality that I think is probably the most important element out of all of these things. And from a practice perspective, I think the aim of practice is really to influence this quality that one has with the world, or one's being in the world, as Heidegger would say. I can just still go on and on and on, but let me rather stop there and just see what you guys want to say about that, and maybe you can expand on anything you want to add.
Well, what occurs to me, someone in Integral Recovery said recently about addiction being separation, and it occurs to me that this second person perspective is about bridging relationship and the recognition that we are all always in relationship with objects, with one another. And so I can see how there is this coming to the awareness of what is in this whole process. So I can see how it's a very profound aspect of the recovery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely, and I think that's the value of seeing, let's call it the second person perspective, or this communion, so wider, in a broader context than merely seeing it in a context of a higher power or spiritual relationships, which can also, you know, give a sense of a sort of otherworldliness to this thing, you know, where it's only about me and God or me or whatever. I think the real importance of it is any relationship or any interaction that you have at any time. You know, all of these things are mediated by the second person attitude. And I think the people that get better in recovery are people that really work hard on their attitude. Whether they have 100 practices or not isn't really the point. It's like you were saying there, Hamlet, put heart behind it. So if you do 4 hours of practice a week with real hearts, and you carry these principles and these attitudes in the way that you live your life, it's going to have a massive amount of transformation compared to doing, you know, 10 things a day and just going through the motions. I don't really see much value in that.
Would you tell the same thing? What about someone early in recovery who has to go to meetings, doesn't necessarily may not want to go to meetings, but needs that structure. I guess that in that instance, it would change, right? I mean, in that instance, that kind of person wouldn't need to put that much heart behind it or doesn't need to have that much heart behind it. They just need to do it, right? At that point, it will still have a strong of an effect without the meaning behind it because that hasn't been established yet.
Yeah, I would say yes and no. Yes, I agree with you totally. But the other element that I think is a lot of people in early recovery bring a huge amount to heart because they're desperate. If one looks under the notion of desperation, there's a huge amount of very profound principles that one applies, whether you like it or not. For instance, you're willing to listen. You're willing to keep quiet when when somebody talks, your sponsor talks, you're actually willing to apply stuff. So a lot of people, I find in early recovery, whether they, completely mad at that stage or not, and emotionally confused, their attitude in the context of spiritual principles are actually very, very highly developed. Which very often becomes less developed because one becomes more arrogant. So I think that's why William James and those guys said I think his words were all real spiritual experiences has its beginning in deflation at depth, and that's why a lot of people have quite profound spiritual experiences when you look at the Buddha and all those guys. After they went through quite a amount of suffering, or there was some serious trauma, because I think that trauma or that suffering, sort of not shatters the ego, but I think it puts the ego in its place. And I mean the ego in the popular sense of the word, one's arrogance and one's opinion that we know everything, it sort of shatters that for a period of time. And when one remains, then one gains a sense of openness and a sense of humility, which are very profound attitudes. And when one applies those attitudes, things happen very quickly. And I think that's why people in early recovery get better very quickly. You see people in 6 months, they change from, being completely insane and useless to like being fairly, solid people within a couple of months. And then later on, one sort of, it's a plateau. And I think it's just because people are desperate and actually apply these principles by default, not because they want to be spiritual or anything. It's just that's what it does to you. That's why that AA says alcohol is the great persuader.
Right. Right. Are we still on the call?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Anyway, I mean, I'm hammering in here on only one perspective. That's only one part of the picture, but I think it's a part that is very often overlooked or not given its due, for lack of a better word. That's why you can get better in recovery immediately if you walk into your first meeting or start recovery. Regardless of your level of development, regardless of your trauma, regardless of your social environment, if one displays the right attitude, then this process can start immediately, and you can stay clean.
Guy, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think we have to finish soon. Anything you guys want to say in closing?
No, I'm good. Thank you for the lecture, guy. That was awesome.
I'm good too. Yes, this has been very helpful. It goes to a very deep level, which is important.
Okay. Well, as usual, it's a pleasure to have you guys on the call, and we'll chat soon again.
Thanks, okay. Guy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay.
Right. Bye. Bye. See you guys Friday. Bye-bye.